The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So, just before I came down here to teach or to sit, there was I saw a little video of this boy's soccer team being discovered in the cave in Thailand. And the reason I got into it and why I kind of read the article that introduced it was that the coach who got trapped with these 11, 12 boys deep in this cave, he'd spent 10 years living in a Buddhist monastery, kind of as a Buddhist monastic. Apparently he entered the monastery, he was an orphan, and when he was 13 or so, and then spent 10 years living there. And so he taught these boys meditation. They had all these days, you know, about 2 weeks in this cave. And in order to conserve their energy and to keep them calm, he taught them meditation. And when the divers first found them, you know, surfaced, I guess, and saw them there, apparently they were all meditating. So, and then they said there was a video of this first encounter. So I got that. I was curious. So I clicked on the video, and there they were in the dark. You know, there was a flashlight from the diver in the darkness of the cave. And sure enough, it looked to me like they were all had all been sitting there meditating. They're all very calm and settled. And the lights came on. You know, the flashlight came on. They opened their eyes and they were just delightfully calm about it. You know, you think like so finally being discovered that they would kind of be ecstatic or over the top somehow. But they seemed calm and centered and not worse for wear for having spent, by that time I think it was 9 days in the cave. It was in Thai, but they must have gone around and shown the light in each one of them, and each one of them said their name or said something. And so each in light shone on a kid, and the kid put his hand together and namaste, and then they went on to the next one, and it was quite lovely to see. So this idea of meditation in times of crisis. So may we have a Thai soccer coach to teach us meditation when we get trapped. So that was a nice story, I thought. And then it reminded me of one of the foremost or most important Buddhist meditation masters of the modern era in the 20th century was a man named Ajahn Mun, and who died probably around late 1940s. And he wrote a long poem that he talks about having discovered a cave of wonders. That through his meditation practice, he was extolling this wonderful cave of wonders that he discovered through meditation. And it's the cave that's in his own body. So somehow he had dropped inside, and he called it a cave of wonders in there. And certainly the inner life that's possible to discover through meditation is like a whole universe. Sometimes I think that the universe within is bigger than the universe without. Just, you know, it's kind of silly to think that way, right? But if you go in there, it just feels like it's so vast. And certainly there's full of wonders and levels of peace and joy and love and delight and wisdom that is quite phenomenal to tap into. So this cave of wonders. So in this teachings of Buddha's teachings on meditation and mindfulness, he makes a very interesting distinction. And the distinction is between, in English, how some translators translate this, is a distinction between worldly feelings and unworldly feelings. I've never been happy with that translation. But the original Pali language words would literally be translated to English as feelings of the flesh and feelings not of the flesh. And how I understand this is, one way to understand this is maybe not complete, but is that there are those feelings that we have that arise because of how we encounter our environment. So if you get a nice massage, then that's maybe a pleasant feelings that you have. If and someone puts their fingernails over the chalkboard, that's an unpleasant feeling. And so, you know, it's very much dependent on circumstances around us. And some people will spend an inordinate amount of time adjusting the circumstances around them to make themselves as comfortable as possible, to avoid discomfort. And they're kind of, some people are kind of, in Buddhist language, would be kind of slaves to comfort or slaves to the environment, constantly adjusting it and making it just right. And so the focus then is outwardly. And so in this language, the way it's translated by some people, is being concerned with the world or the impact the world has on us. And if our well-being and happiness and peace is dependent on the senses and how the senses are impacted by the world around us, then we're not really independent of the world. We're not free of the world. We're actually, again, the very strong language in Buddhism is you're kind of enslaved to the world then and caught by it, and you have to constantly be adjusting and changing and wanting and making things better and getting away from things, and everything's dependent on getting the condition just right so we can feel good. The feelings not of the flesh are feelings that arise independent of what happens in the world outside of us. And so things can happen, and unpleasant things can happen, but inside we can feel quite content, happy, we can feel peaceful, we can feel, you know, that somehow we're centered in a place where, you know, it's unfortunate what's happening maybe, but we're not a big deal. Someone could, suddenly there could be a lot of noise around IMC. Sometimes we have, usually not Monday nights, but other times when we have meditation sessions here, the neighbors have leaf blowers. And some people are annoyed sitting meditating. But, you know, for me, hearing a leaf blower is just it's kind of a sound out there. And it doesn't really touch what goes on inside. And I continue my meditation kind of untouched by what's happening out there with the leaf blowers. Even though it's unpleasant for the ears, it's not really an issue for this feelings not of the flesh. So one way that this distinction is made between of the flesh and not of the flesh, of the senses and not of the senses, is that one of them has to do with sensations that put us, that not of the flesh are those that put us on the path to liberation, to freedom. And of the flesh, more often than not, keep people entangled and caught in the world and all that. And so, you know, to some degree you can see that we, when we are reactive to the experiences around us, to experiences that come in through the senses, the eyes, the ears, and all this, that if we're reactive, we get angry, or we get desirous and greedy, or we get envious, or we get, you know, all these reactions that we have. One way or other, we contract, or get tight, or get stressed by it. And those are not moving us towards freedom, they're moving us in the opposite direction of freedom. And so part of what we do in mindfulness practice is to start becoming aware of the impact that the world has on us, or how we react to what goes on around us. And rather than think that we have to fix the world or get angry at the world or criticize the world or blame the world because it's just not right for us, in such a way that we get more contracted, we get more tight, we get more stressed, we're looking for another way to be in the world. And one of the ways to learn this different way is to learn how not to get reactive, to pause, to make space, to to be able to recognize and see clearly what's happening. But in that recognition, in that mindfulness, there's no agitation in the mind or no tightening or resisting or pulling back. It's just kind of an open awareness where we're centered, peaceful, aware of what's there. And I don't know if this is a useful analogy, but it was a nice reference point for me when I started my meditation practice. When I was a somewhat little kid, sometimes we would take the car to a car wash where you could stay in the car as I went through the wash. And I found that so much fun because it would be outside and the windows are rolled up and you get to just splash of water and suds and then these big rolling brushes kind of brushing everything and just like this chaos outside. And inside the cab of the car, it's just peaceful. And I just felt so cozy and, you know, safe and wonderful to be inside and have this chaos outside. So I associated that experience kind of with meditation, that somehow I was tapping into this cab, the cab of awareness, that was a peaceful place. And no matter how chaotic it was around, I could stay dry, in a sense, by staying in the awareness bubble, in the attention bubble, or stay grounded. And I certainly didn't learn to do it, you know, quickly and automatically. But that reference point helped me a lot to start seeing how much I reacted, how much I would get upset or want to attack or blame or spin out in my thoughts and ideas or shut down or close up or all kinds of things that, you know, all kinds of reactive ways that I had. And it was a slow, gradual learning about how I reacted, which was so helpful for me. And I would say that that's one of the foundations of doing Buddhist meditation practice, is not becoming wise about how to be free, but becoming wise about how we're unfree. And so rather than kind of being in a hurry to be peaceful, in a hurry to be wise, or be hurry to be, you know, non-reactive or something, what we want to do in Buddhist meditation is to be in a hurry to recognize how we get caught, how we are reactive. And then to do it with compassion, to do it, you don't want to get caught by your caughtness. So you just want to see it. But the more we can see and learn the reactive activities of the mind, the wiser we can become about those reactivities. The more we can know about our anger, the more we can know about our fears, the more we can know about how that works. It's kind of like learning how the trick is done, learning how it is that we get caught in it, how we get pulled into it. The beliefs that are operating, the feelings that are operating, all kinds of things that are operating. And then what happens over time, because we know ourselves so well, we'll find ourselves getting less and less caught, less and less reactive, less and less believing in the reactivity, less interested in the reactivity, and not so committed to the reactivity, less inclined to invest a lot of energy into it. And so then starts being a little separation from it, and we start finding that there's another way of being. And there's a feeling of goodness, or feeling of wholeness, or feeling of peacefulness, just simply kind of feeling of less reactivity, which starts feeling good, feels right. And that feeling of not being caught, not being reactive, that goodness of that feeling is a feeling not of the flesh, not of the senses, you know, reacting to what's going on. And to begin to and be able to recognize that there are these feelings that go on inside that are not part of the reactive mode of the senses in the world and all that. And to feel the goodness of it, to feel the freedom there or the ease there or the whatever, you know, different people feel experience it different ways, different times. But to start feeling that and appreciating that and see that, yes, in fact, there is a difference between the kind of feelings and well-being we can feel when our senses are stimulated by the world and this whole other thing that begins waking up inside of us when we kind of learn to be freer and freer, when we learn to be centered and stable inside in this cave of wonders. And it turns out that this vast universe inside can be a really beautiful place to be. To let the mind become still and quiet enough, we can start noticing all these things inside here that go unnoticed when we're caught up in preoccupations and thoughts and ideas. And so one of the nice things that can happen in meditation is that we become less interested in all the things we can be thinking about, all the preoccupations. And they don't necessarily fall away and we stop thinking right away, but rather they become less interesting. And in my mind, I get this feeling sometimes that my thoughts kind of recede to the side and back behind me. So the thoughts are still operating, but I'm not in them anymore. They're kind of like, as the boat goes through the water, they're the wake of the boat, as opposed to the wall that I'm hitting myself against or something. So the idea is just kind of, those thoughts just there in the background, and they're falling away and falling away and falling away. And then sometimes they fall away and it gets very quiet and peaceful. So in teachings of the Buddha, one of the strongest reference points, biggest reference points for these sensations not of the flesh have to do with renunciation. That's the language that they use in the ancient texts. And renunciation is not a popular word, as I've been told, in the modern West. And I've heard people sometimes say, oh, these Western Buddhist teachers, they don't talk enough about renunciation because they only want to give popular teachings. So you can go home now if you want, if you don't want to hear. But renunciation is not, this word renunciation is probably it's an English word coming from Latin, and it's not probably a good choice for this Pali word nekamma. Because I think associations a lot of people have with renunciation is what you're giving up. And certainly in Buddhism you're giving up attachments and clinging and things. But the emphasis is not what you're giving up, but what you gain in the process of it. And so I think in some kind of Western ideas of renunciation, it's sometimes associated almost with asceticism. Like you renounce in order to live a life of poverty or something. And certainly the Buddhist monastics are living lives of kind of poverty, though it's not meant to be exactly poor. And that's not really the idea, but it kind of looks like that from, because they have no money, for example. But I'll tell you a little story. There was a man who used to teach for us, a monk, a wonderful monk named Ajahn Amaro, lived in California, Englishman who lived in California for many years. And when he first came to California, to San Francisco, someone gave him a tour, a walking tour, I think, of the financial district in San Francisco, and was talking about the American financial system. And then his tour guide said to him at some point, you're wealthier than most Americans. And he said, no, how can that be? I don't have any money at all. And the man said, yes, but you're not in debt. So I think the emphasis in Buddhism is not so much on what we're certainly giving up things, but the emphasis is not on what we lose, but what we gain instead. And we're supposed to gain these beautiful things, and inner things, this cave of wonder. It's supposed to move us towards greater, and the language of Buddhism is inner wealth. So for example, there's some of the things that are considered inner wealth in Buddhism loving kindness, capacity for love. There is contentment as a form of inner wealth. Sometimes faith is considered a form of inner wealth. And probably we can add to the list of things. There's a beautiful, serene forms of happiness and joy. There's feelings of deep, con- deep equanimity that can arise. And so, but to have this inner wealth grow and be present for us, it requires things of us. Many of us can't just continue life as usual. If life as usual means that we're too preoccupied in our pursuits, in our fears, in our anxieties, in our resentments, in our ambitions, that we're kind of, the mind is always busy and engaged and thinking and kind of lost in itself. There's no room. Then the mind, the heart, the inner life gets claustrophobic very quickly. And so we have to let go of something. Some Buddhist teachers say, well, you don't have to actually let go of things, but you have to let go of your attachment to things. So I don't know if if you have too many stuff to take care of, it's not enough just to let go of your attachment. Sometimes there's simplifying our lives so that we can gain something. And it's classically, very commonly, many people who are serious with doing Buddhist meditation practice, sooner or later will start simplifying their lives. And even things which are normally very wonderful to do, and there's nothing wrong with doing them, they find that simplifying their lives gives them something even greater and better, because they can't do all the recreational opportunities the world gives us. Because it's, you know, as fun as it is, it's worldly fun. It's fun of the senses in a certain way. And so it doesn't maybe help this connection to this deeper part of ourselves, with this cave of wonders. So the idea that it's inner wealth, so renunciation, what can we simplify? What can we let go of? And the other reference point in the Buddhist teachings for this feelings not of the flesh is concentration practice. That deep concentration practice, that's more than just being mindful, but being mindful in such a way that the mind gets really collected and settled and focused. So the mind becomes harmonized or harmonious, unified. So not only is the mind, the thinking, quieted down, but the mental energies that we have get gathered together in a way that's quite beautiful, because things are unified in harmony, centered and focused. And there's seemingly all kinds of physiological things that kick into place when the mind is in a harmonious, focused, concentrated state. There's a lot of pleasure, a lot of joy, a lot of strong sense of well-being that can arise. And for people who haven't experienced this kind of meditative joy that can arise, maybe that one of the closest reference points for it is that if you have some activity you do, like maybe you're reading a really good book, or you have a craft that you get absorbed doing, or playing a musical instrument, you get absorbed in the instrument, where, you know, the time disappears, the world outside of where you are disappears, you're not thinking about your problems and your concerns, but you're really right there, so much so that if someone says something to you, you know, it's like, you know, what would you like for dinner? You don't hear them because you're so absorbed in what you're doing. And some people, when they have that kind of absorption, it really feels nice. It feels clean. It feels nice. It feels like a break, vacation from all the scattered, contracted activities of the mind. So I don't know if any of you have a reference point like that, but when we get absorbed in meditation, it's like doing that, you know, 10 times stronger or something. You know, it's like much more intensified, and the feelings feel much more full or complete throughout the body. It's a wonderful thing to have. So the Buddha makes this distinction between two kinds of feelings: feelings of the flesh and feelings not of the flesh. And the most common translation for this is worldly feelings and unworldly feelings, which I kind of think is a little unfortunate, but If worldly, you know, sometimes in the West we think of worldly as kind of like being involved in all the wrong things in the world. And so it sets up a dichotomy between, you know, parts of the world. Ideally, in Buddhism, we're not setting up a dichotomy, but rather we're freeing ourselves so that our hearts and awareness can be inclusive of it all, but not caught in it, as opposed to here and there, that's bad and this is good. It's more like we drop, almost like we drop that dichotomy, and the awareness, this inner goodness, this cave of wonders gets expansive and open so that it includes everything within it. But to start seeing this difference, to feel, start recognizing that there is goodness, there's feelings of rightness, there's a direction to go that we start feeling when we start becoming freer, when we stop being caught so much in our activities and concerns, and to appreciate that, to value it. It's the valuing and appreciating it of it, if we take the time to do that, that allows it to grow, that allows it to be a North Star, a guide for us to move more and more in that direction. But if we don't recognize it, then it might not be a North Star. It might not be something that directs us and where to go and supports us in greater and greater growth in this practice. So, a fundamental teaching in Buddhism, worldly and unworldly, flesh and not of the flesh. So, do you have any comments or any questions you'd like to ask about this or anything else?
Can you speak to unpleasant, unworldly feelings?
Yes, there's also in this ancient text, there's a discussion about unpleasant, unworldly feelings. So these sometimes these of the flesh are unpleasant as well. And the primary reference point for this is idea of this is that if the path to liberation, the path of practice and freedom that was taught here is something a person really wants to do. They really want to go on retreat. They really want to meditate. They really want to engage in this, but they can't. And so the frustration or the feeling of something, the unpleasantness of that, that's considered to be an unpleasant feeling associated with renunciation. So we'd like to move in that direction of renunciation, but we can't. And so sometimes there are worldly responsibilities. That means that people have a strong drive, a strong need, perhaps, for some kind of new change in their life towards practice or freedom or some new values. And they just can't make the change because of responsibilities they have, or sometimes other things get in the way. And then the feeling of, disappointment or frustration, or I don't know if those are the right words or feelings. I know I went through a period of time where it was the most important thing for me was to go back on retreat, and I've been on retreat in Thailand, and it was life changing. My first Vipassana retreat, and it became really important to go back. But there were circumstances that visas and money and things like that that didn't allow me to go back right away. And so it was kind of a little bit, I think of it a little bit as a dark night of the soul. I don't know if that's the right use of the term. But, I felt kind of, it was a hard time for me to feel like I had a strong drive, strong to go off and practice and not be able to follow through. And that was kind of a difficult time until finally I was able to go and I don't know if this, what you think of me if I tell you the story, but it happened. So I was in Bangkok, and the place I really wanted to go practice meditation was in Burma, but it was very hard back then to get into Burma. It was pretty much of a closed country, but they had this one category of visa called meditation visa, which you could allow you to stay long, Western foreigners to stay in Burma much longer than the otherwise get in. And so I finally in the Burmese embassy in Bangkok, they finally put that meditation visa stamp on my passport, and so I was going to go and do this deep meditation, unworldly meditation in Burma. And so I was started leaving down, walking down the street, or skipping. I was skipping down the street outside the embassy, singing to myself, "You can get it if you really want." But you got to try. I don't know if that, you know, was the original intention of that song, but. So does that answer your question well enough? I saw a hand over here.
Thank you. So this gets, I guess, to the... the green light is on. Like this. Like this. Yeah, there you go. So I've had the experience that you described of the cave, the inner cave, which leads me to want it and to want to, I become like disappointed if I don't get there. And it's like maybe it's an attachment to achieving that spaciousness. And so I'd like you to speak about that.
Yeah, it was certainly it's easy to get attached and cling to it, and it's good to look more deeply and, you know, at it. And it's not a crime to be attached, but it is something to study. It is something to understand and look more deeply. What's going on for you when you get attached? What are your beliefs? What are your values? What are you attached to specifically? Is it the pleasure of it? Is it that now you think you're the coolest meditator on your block? And what's going on? So it's really a very important object of attention, of mindfulness, is to understand what you're doing, what's happening there. And then over time, you might discover, be able to differentiate between different kinds of feelings. Because if that cave of wonders, if there's a really good feeling here, some people have certain kind of experiences in meditation that are life-changing. They have experienced themselves in completely different ways, in new ways they never could have imagined was possible. And then it's not so much that they want that again, as much as sometimes it's just they're so fed up with, or so discouraged, or so it feels so wrong to go back to the way things were before. And it's not exactly an attachment. It's almost like a healthy, well, why would I put salt in my wound again? You know, I finally stopped putting salt in it, so why should I, that I keep putting salt? I don't want to do that anymore. Just seems wrong anymore. So sometimes it's a strong reaction to going back into the business as usual, how it used to be. And that rather, it looks like an attachment, but it's really a movement towards health.
And so it feels like, I guess, in some ways it's like a yearning to be in that unity.
Yes. And so sometimes a very strong yearning, I like the word aspiration, is... can be very strong, so it can look like an attachment. Like I'm not supposed to want something to happen. You know, anytime I really want something, that's attachment. But there can be very healthy desires for freedom, desires for this new way of being. And it can be frustrated. In that frustration, the strong yearning, the strong desire, and not being able to follow through can be awkward and difficult to go through. But it might not represent an attachment so much. And to call it an attachment might make it more difficult than it needs to be.
So I guess the question has to do with process. So like in the meditation we just were doing, I kept like trying to do all the right things, follow the breath and, be with the moment and notice any sensations, and it really wasn't until you started talking that actually it started to open up a little bit.
So one of the tasks of mindfulness meditation is to monitor how we're doing the practice. So to a little bit. Some people get so self-conscious that they just tie themselves in knots. And so then it's better to just be really simple and just do breath meditation and don't make it any more complicated than that. And let everything else fall away. Just come back to the breath, come back to the breath. But sometimes it's good to monitor how you're practicing. So, for example, a person can have too many ideas of what's supposed to happen, what they're supposed to do, and so they're constantly trying, oh, I'm not supposed to do this breath and that breath and this, you know, and they're just making themselves more busy, you know, rather than less busy. So by monitoring how we're doing the practice, we can get the information that, you know, I'm trying too hard here. I think I need to lighten up and not try so hard and trust. I'll keep doing the practice, but just trust it that it works.
I think efforting is, definitely going on.
So then monitoring the effort level and then experimenting with different forms of effort. You know, try doing less or different kinds or, you know. It's all a process of learning. And if you approach meditation, this mindfulness meditation, learning opportunities, rather than that you're supposed to have a certain experience. What you learn is portable and useful in all kinds of circumstances. Experiences you have, some of them are valuable, but experiences are temporary.
Well, what do you mean by the learning?
If you learn how you get caught, how you get attached to something, then you might be able to recognize that attachment arising in different circumstances in your life and then not get attached. But if you think meditation is about having a feeling of peace, and the peace is not accessible, then you go around frustrated all the time. So because experiences come and go, so it's more useful to focus on the lessons to study and look at and see what's really going on, than it is to get too concerned with the actual actual experience you're having. Does it make some sense?
It's a glimmer of sense.
A glimmer of sense. We'll settle for that. Small steps of growth. Meditation is a lot about small little steps of growth over a long time. And, you know, it accumulates over time. And over time, it makes a huge difference. But each day, it's just a teeny step. So, I hope the world of the flesh is good for you. I hope the world not of the flesh is spectacular for you. Thank you.